Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Artie Johnson reporting. The leaders of Russia, Ukraine, France, and Germany spoke by phone today about a French-German peace plan and will meet Wednesday in the Belarusian capital of Minsk to continue work on resolving the Ukraine crisis. Meantime, Secretary of State John Kerry, French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, and German Foreign Minister Frank-Walter Steinmeier addressed the crisis at the Munich Security Conference, where VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reports.
Kerry addressed concerns that there is a rift between the U.S. and its European allies on the issue of providing Ukraine with defensive lethal weapons.
There is no division. There is no split. I keep hearing people trying to create one. We are united. We are working closely together. We all agree that this challenge will not end through military force.
German Foreign Minister Steinmeier spoke of negotiations between his country and France with Russian President Vladimir Putin. He says negotiators are far from finding a political solution to the crisis. Fabio said Western allies must not agree to concessions that could undermine European security. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Munich.
Nigeria will postpone the February 14th presidential election 6 weeks due to concerns about the Boko Haram insurgency and other security issues. The head of the country's Independent National Electoral Commission, Atira Jigu, told a news conference Saturday the election must be pushed back to protect voters.
The commission has decided to reschedule the 2015 general elections thus. The national elections, i.e. presidential and national assembly, are now to hold on March 28, 2015.
Experts say because Boko Haram militants control large parts of northeastern Nigeria, a peaceful vote would be likely impossible. This is VOA News. Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says he favors a nuclear deal with world powers as long as the pact does not go against the best interests of the Islamic nation. The Iranian leader made his comments in Iran to Air Force personnel about the same time his foreign minister was speaking in Munich about a possible nuclear pact. Javad Zarif said he engaged in serious discussions today with Secretary of State John Kerry about Iran's nuclear status, warning that the only way to deal with Iran is through respect and negotiation. He was also critical of economic sanctions imposed on Iran. Baghdad's decade-old curfew has ended just hours after a series of bombs killed at least 37 people and wounded scores of others. The nighttime curfew was put in place in the capital in an attempt to reduce violence and kidnappings. In another development on Saturday, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi met with Vice President Joe Biden and Secretary of State John Kerry in Munich, where U.S. officials say they discussed efforts to fight the Islamic State and talked about the importance of a whole government approach to provide sound local governance, reconstruction, and economic opportunity in areas liberated from the Islamic State group. Jordanian fighter jets struck Islamic State targets for a third straight day Saturday, as the militants claimed that a Jordanian airstrike killed an American hostage remained unconfirmed. Jordan launched the raids to avenge the killing of a Jordanian pilot the Islamic State group captured in Syria in December. United Arab Emirates said Saturday it also ordered a squadron of F-16 fighter planes to help Jordan with the airstrikes. Both Jordan and the UAE are part of the U.S.-led coalition attacking the militants in captured territory in Iraq and Syria. Here in Washington, President Obama says the country must always resist the urge to overreach when it comes to getting involved in global crises. Mr. Obama has released a new document outlining his national security strategy. White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice echoed some of the president's points during a speech in Washington.
Fundamentally, it's a strategy to strengthen the foundations of America's power, political, economic, and military, and to sustain American leadership in this new century so that we can surmount the challenges of today and capture the opportunities of tomorrow.
The security document makes no major policy changes, but clarifies the U.S. approach to a number of challenges, from the fight against Islamic State militants to Russian actions in Ukraine. Some Republican lawmakers have criticized Mr. Obama for what they say is an inadequate response to global threats. Egyptian authorities have set February 12th as the start of the retrial for two remaining jailed Al Jazeera journalists. A lawyer for one of the journalists made the announcement today. Egyptian journalist Bahar Mohammed and Canadian-Egyptian Mohammed Fahmy were sentenced last year to 10 and 7 years in jail. Their retrial was ordered last month. Their companion, Peter Grest, was released and deported. I'm Artie Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The concerns of the president center around number one, the issue of security situation in the Northeast, where some Nigerians are resident.
The Nigerian Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, postpones the general election from February 14 to March 28.
INEC has assured that they were ready for this election, and they were even more prepared than they were prepared for 2011 election. So, and you see, at the beginning, the government was hinting, or rather the proponent of postponement.
Nigerian opposition accuses the government of sabotaging the country's democracy. We'll have details.
If you look at football these days, it's changing. There's no nation that can be said it's a bigger or smaller nation. Football is fast developing all nations.
And Zimbabweans bet on which country will win today's finals of the Africa Cup of Nations. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A senior advisor to Nigerian incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan has denied reports that the government pressured the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, to postpone the February election to March 28. Doyin Okupe told me earlier that the administration only urged the electoral body to ensure prospective Nigerian voters are not disenfranchised.
The concerns of the president center around number one, the issue of security situation in the Northeast, where some Nigerians are residents and they are innocent Nigerians, and there is a possibility that they will be disenfranchised for no other reason than they are residents in an area where insurgency is operational. Number two, the duty of democracy is the guarantee of personal personal liberties and the right of choice. Why it is not compulsory for every Nigerian to have the PVC, but every Nigerian that has indicated interest in taking part in the election should be given the opportunity to make his own choice whether he wants to vote or not. But if I don't have PVC, then I cannot make that choice. And by the admission of the INEC chairman, 34% of registered voters do not have their PVC. So there's a problem about that. Then finally, we've got to do things in such a way that we do not directly or indirectly undermine the credibility of the total electoral process. Because to do so is to allow for a situation where a winner emerges and the loser express the inadequacies and the imperfections in the system to create mayhem.
Dr. Okupe, critics say that the presidency is hell-bent on postponing the elections because the perception is that the president might lose the election. That is why he's seeking to postpone the election. What do you say to those criticisms?
I'm sorry, those criticisms are almost unreasonable. Because if you think you're going to lose an election, how does postponing it for 2 days, 3 days, or 6 weeks, how does it affect your chances of winning? That is actual nonsense and it is not correct. It is not true, but it's not unlike our position here to spread such rumor. In terms of preparedness, in terms of structure, in terms of the chances of winning, President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan still stands several miles apart from President candidate of APC, General Buhari. General Buhari has been defeated by the PDP 3 times in previous elections. On this fourth occasion, his reliance is on the possibility of massive support from the Southwest, which is not happening, and he has not done well in his campaign. He has not spoken for more than 2 minutes in any campaign ground. He has refused to take his opponent on debate. Who can be afraid of such a candidate? It doesn't make sense.
What does the presidency want to tell Nigerians about these concerns that you just expressed?
Well, I mean, we have heard that before from the INEC chairman, that the INEC is ready and all that. It happened in Imo. And yet, you know, the election that certainly took place was a near fiasco. It also happened in 2011. INEC was supposed to be ready, and everything was supposed to be in place. But last minute, on the day of election, INEC itself canceled the election and postponed it by 1 week. You know, the president has a responsibility to Nigerian people, all right, irrespective of all whatever people may say. It is our own duty and responsibility to ensure that things are done properly so as to avoid trouble and confusion subsequently.
So, Dr. Akupe, what time period is the presidency advocating that the Electoral Commission could hold off?
The presidency is not advocating any period. The presidency is asking INEC to meet with his own people and check his own internal mechanism and see how the earliest time, apart from the 14th of February, that the election can actually be held in a proper atmosphere and with no chance of actually disenfranchising any Nigerian who's ready to vote.
That means that the reports that the presidency is advocating that the election should be held in April are false. That's what you're saying.
Well, I'm not aware that the presidency is advocating any particular date, but we're just saying that they should use their own internal arrangements and conserve for that and find a date that is within the law and that, you know, we'll be able to, allow security agencies to provide adequate security where it is necessary and such a good time that we allow for those who have not been given their PDCs to collect them.
Doyin Okupe is a special advisor to Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Abuja. Following the postponement of elections in Nigeria, the opposition is accusing the government of trying to subvert the will of the people. Alhaji Lai Mohammed is the spokesman for the main opposition, All Progressives Congress, APC. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the commercial capital, Lagos, for his reaction.
Well, it's unacceptable to us and we reject it. Because what we are facing really is not a postponement. It's more of a coup d'etat. A situation where the military would blackmail the election management body by threatening to withdraw security for an election that they were aware of more than a year ago. The reason being profiled, which is security, is laughable. They were aware of the election timetable months ago. Only 5 days ago, the same media said they were ready for this. So what changed between then and now? Come back and the presidency, they've been battling for 6 years and they have not been able to conquer. They are going to do it in 6 weeks.
So the issue of Boko Haram insurgents aside, do you think, in your opinion, the INEC was ready to hold this election?
Oh, INEC has assured us they were ready to hold this election, that they were even more prepared than they were prepared for 2011 election. So, you see, at the beginning, the government was hinging, or rather the proponents of postponement were hinging the argument on the availability of the permanent voter card. Now, that is no longer a valid excuse. We are now going to security, which is the most nebulous excuse.
What do you think will be the impact of this postponement on the opposition?
One, it will generally demoralize our supporters, and the eventual turnout might not be what it ought to be. But more importantly is that we don't believe the intent of this election at all. Because don't forget, what the military said was that if the situation improves in 6 weeks, what guarantee that Sudan will improve in 6 weeks? And if it does not, or if they escalate the situation, then who will hold them, who will be held responsible? So I think the entire world should understand that what is happening is political interference in the process of in the election process. It's an attempt to truncate democracy.
So you're saying that there's no guarantee that this election will be held on March 28th, as the INEC says now?
Absolutely none. That's none. That's none, because the letter from the team of defense staff to the electoral amendment body is that they are advising a postponement for an initial 6 weeks. And I remember yesterday, when this question was put to Professor Jega,
he threw up his hand and said, let's pray this place will improve.
Why do you think the government is trying to buy more time for this election?
Because they know they are not popular. They know that if the elections are held today, they will lose more fully. So they want to use this 6 weeks, if at all elections hold at all, one, demoralize the opposition, two, put a lot of obstacles in our way, three, continue their smear campaign against our candidate, Buhari, perfect leading, you know, options, then also neutralize the entire country. This is what they intend to achieve within the 6 weeks.
Lastly, how is the mood among the people? Do the people welcome the change or they condemn the change?
People are very angry. People are very angry. Going by the sexism, feeding, going by the expression of Nigerians in the media. But generally, I think they're even much more determined against this government than before.
Alhaji Lai Mohammed is the spokesman for the Nigerian main opposition, the All Progressive Congress, APC. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Lagos. For the latest fallout following Nigeria's election postponement, reporter Medina Dauda from the VOA Hausa Service, currently in Abuja, joins us live via telephone link up. Hello, Medina.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening to you. How are you in Abuja?
We're good here.
Thank you. Medina, tell me, what are Nigerians telling you particularly about their reaction to the postponement of this election?
The views of Nigerians that we have had to interview from the federal capital city here in Abuja are somehow divided on the suspension of the election. Some are for it, some are against it. You know, so it's a difficult thing to actually say now which number is higher. The ones that are against it or for it. But everywhere you go to, people have diverse views about the suspension. But they are also asking a series of questions. For instance, those we interviewed are asking, how come the issue of security is coming up now when we have some few days to get to the election, when in 5.5 years, that same security situation has not improved? And again, they are also asking why the Independent National Electoral Commission, that is supposed to be an independent body, is responding to calls from the presidency. In other words, it's like they are being dictated to as to what to do as regards the election. Because when the chairman of Independent Electoral Commission, Atahir Jega, was meeting with the three sets of people, first, the political party leaders, and secondly, civil society organizations, and thirdly, the resident electoral commissioners from the 36 states and the Federal Capital Territory, which makes 37, were still meeting throughout yesterday. The result of the meeting, which means that the postponement and date of the election were already on the social media. So that one also is creating a lot of furore. And people are asking a series of questions.
Now, Medina, Medina, you're talking about the independence of the Electoral Commission. Obviously, it is funded by the state. So those who control the levers of powers, supposedly, sometimes could call the shot. Is this the situation on the ground?
Well, that is what the people that we have interviewed are saying. Everybody is expecting the Independent National Electoral Commission to be fully independent because it is being financed by money from taxpayers, you know, Nigerians or taxpayers. So they don't want INEC to be answerable to the presidency. They want INEC to be fully independent so as it could take its decisions without having influences from outside the commission.
Obvious.
But right now, as it is, the picture that is painted to people is showing like the INEC chairman is taking shots from the presidency, which people are not really happy about.
Now, Medina, obviously there are different opinions there, but the INEC's explanation about the postponement of the election, how are people reading into it? How are they accepting the reasoning? Because some people are saying, well, if
security within these areas that often come under Boko Haram attack, security cannot be guaranteed there, then there's no need to organize the election until those places, those areas are secured.
Or else... I will tell you the questions they are asking, as I earlier told you. Now, the security situation has prevailed for 5.5 years. The question we are asked by Nigerians that we interview is, how are we going to solve the security situation in 6 weeks? This is something that has continued in 5.5 years. And we do not have answers to that. Is the security personnel and, of course, the Nigerian government that should respond to such questions as to how they are going to curb the security situation in 6 weeks. This is what has persisted in 5.5 years. So that is casting a lot of doubt in the minds of people.
Now, Medina, let me ask you this.
The security issue is being used just to scuttle the election.
Medina, let me ask you this. Speaking to Dr. Doyin Okupe earlier, he said that postponing of the election for 6 weeks is unlikely to benefit one or the other. Are the opposition supporters agreeing or accepting this explanation from the presidency?
The opposition are against that explanation. They are not accepting it at all. Right now, as I'm speaking with you, I'm at the APC briefing center for the Buhari Presidential Campaign Organization, because they want to make it official. They want to make their stand official. But before now, the publicity secretary of APC, Alhaji Mohammed, has told us that the postponement does not go down well with the APC, which is the opposition party. You know, both sides are playing the blame game, because APC is blaming the PDP, PDP is blaming the APC. But as it is, all the questions that people are asking, as we are supposed to be asking the political parties and, of course, the security agencies that we can access to respond to most of the questions that we are getting from the people. Like, they ask, for 5.5 years, the security situation has prevailed. How is the government going to curtail it in 6 weeks?
Thank you.
That's a difficult question for someone like me to answer, because I'm not a politician. So all I need to do is to possibly ask the security agents to tell us how they intend to take care of security in 6 weeks.
Well,
another issue that comes up again.
Medina, we need to go. We'll continue with this later on. Thank you very much. Medina Dauda is a reporter with VOA Hausa Service. She joined us live from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Turning to East Africa, a Californian merchants bank, which accounts up to 80% of money transfer services to Somalia, stopped services on Friday over fears that some of the funds may fall into the hands of militant groups like Al-Shabaab. The UN is warning that cutting the services will have a devastating impact on the humanitarian situation in the country. VOA Somali Service Editor Harun Maruf spoke with Philippe Lazzarini, UN Special Representative of the Secretary General and Resident and Humanitarian Coordinator for Somalia about the impact of the bank's decision.
Remittances into Somali society are extremely important. I mean, we estimate them from $1 to $1.5 billion. And most of the families, receiving remittances are just using it to buy food, to have access to health, or to provide education to their children. So cutting remittances will have a devastating impact in Somalia. And we also know that the humanitarian situation is dire. So there is no doubt that if this vital lifeline is cut, it will have a serious impact on the daily life of the Somalis.
And with the humanitarian situation on the ground now, cutting this lifeline, how is it going to impact it? Give me some examples of what could happen.
Well, the impact will be measured in the months to come. We know today that we have these 700,000-800,000 people who are in emergency crisis. We know we have 2 million people who are teetering on the edge of the food crisis. So now, if we cut these remittances, the number of these people in 6 months, 9 months' time will significantly increase, and those who were in a crisis, in a stress situation, will enter into a crisis situation. Don't forget, I mean, Somalia has gone through a devastating famine only 3 years ago. And at that time, we had the remittances. If we wouldn't have had the remittances, I mean, the impact of the famine would have been certainly more severe.
What are the alternatives? What are you going to do? What's the solution?
Well, listen, I mean, the longer-term solution, we all know it, is to have a functioning banking system in Somalia. Now, we are all involved in this peace and state-building agenda, and we are hopeful that in the coming 5-8 years, we will have a functioning banking system. I think the first licensed bank in Mogadishu started at the end of 2014. Meanwhile, what is important is that the regulator in countries where, I mean, remittances are coming from authorize banks, I mean, to have this kind of money transfer with a country like Somalia. If you look at, I mean, countries where this money is coming from in Europe or in the U.S., these are all countries which are, I mean, deeply involved in the peace and state-building agenda. But cutting, I mean, this lifeline is also undermining our effort and our gain, the political gain, the security gain, but also the economic gains.
Philippe Lazzarini is the UN Deputy Special Representative of the Secretary General to Somalia. He spoke with VOA Somali Service Editor Harun Maruf from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. The curtain comes down at the Africa Cup of Nations tournament later today, with two West African teams fighting for the continent's coveted cup. Betting houses in Zimbabwe have been active during the past 22 days of the tournament. VOA Zimbabwe Service reporter Michael Kiriati has more details from the capital, Harare.
Some football fans are counting the cost of their losses, while those who place their faith on Ivory Coast and the Black Stars of Ghana has every reason to smile. But the guessing game that has been going on comes to an end in the Equatorial Guinea on Sunday, with indications that the balance of football power is shifting from North Africa to other parts of the continent. Former Zimbabwe national team goalkeepers coach Nkululeko Dlamini is among soccer critics who believe that West Africa is becoming a force to reckon with in African soccer.
If you look at football these days, it's changing. There's no nation that can be said it's a bigger or smaller nation. Football is fast developing all nations.
The Super Eagles of Nigeria, who unfortunately could not defend their title as they fell by the wayside in the qualifiers, are the current holders of the cup. North African giant Egypt have won the tournament a record 7 times, while Tunisia have 2 titles and Algeria has 1. Ghana last won the title 33 years ago, while the Ivorians have come close twice in the past 3 editions by reaching the finals. Jets United supporter Farah Mugoni thinks the elephant's misery will continue. In fact, there is so much belief in the Black Stars that even another football follower, Jivas Makoni, says he has raised enough money to place his bet on the Black Stars.
Personally, I'm betting Ghana.
However, it would be folly to underestimate the overall strength and team spirit of the Ivorians, once one of Africa's top-ranked teams. But whatever happens, the truth is that the trophy will remain in West Africa for another 2 years. While the curtain is coming down on the Africa Cup of Nations, the Zimbabwe Premier Soccer League have announced that the 2015 soccer program will begin on March 1 without the traditional season opening knockout tournament. Initially, the Mbada Diamonds Cup, which was called off last season, was supposed to open up the season, but this will not be the case as the company has failed to mobilize enough financial resources.
That was Michael Kariati reporting from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, February 8th. After 31 matches played over the past 22 days, the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations wraps up today, Sunday. Let's do a quick recap. The Central African nation of Equatorial Guinea hosted the tournament after original host Morocco backed out over Ebola fears. The tournament, the 38th edition, featured 16 teams in the finals. The finalists are host Equatorial Guinea, Congo, Gabon, Burkina Faso, Tunisia, Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, Cape Verde, Zambia, Ghana, Algeria, Senegal, South Africa, Ivory Coast, Guinea, Mali, and Cameroon. In the round-robin first round, Mali, Cameroon, Senegal, South Africa, Cape Verde, Zambia, Burkina Faso, and Gabon were eliminated. Another 8 teams, Congo, Equatorial Guinea, Tunisia, DR Congo, Ghana, Algeria, Ivory Coast, and Guinea advanced to the quarterfinals. Then DR Congo, Ivory Coast, Ghana, and Equatorial Guinea reached the last 4, which is the semifinals. Today, Sunday's final is between Ivory Coast and Ghana. Ahead of the final match, Equatorial Guinea ended the tournament on a low note as it lost the third place match 4-2 on penalties after playing goalless with DR Congo on Saturday. Javier Balboa and Raul Fabiani both missed their penalty kicks, while all 4 DR Congo penalty kickers found the net, with Cedric Mogongo firing home the decisive kick. Although supporters likely stayed away from the playoff, after the fan violence that marked Equatorial Guinea's semi-final defeat to Ghana on Thursday, those in attendance created a fitting atmosphere for the host final match. The two defeated semi-finalists played out a low-key but well-tempered goalless draw and had to be separated by the first penalty shootout of the 2015 tournament. One sad aspect of the 2015 tournament is crowd violence. The semi-final clash between the host and Ghana witnessed violent scenes in Malabo on Thursday that saw at least 36 people injured, one seriously. The game, which Ghana won 3-0, was stopped for more than 30 minutes near the end as objects were thrown from the stands at the opposing team, officials and fans by locals who were angry at the demise of their team. That violence prompted organizers to take extra security measures for today's Sunday's final. Media director of the Confederation of African Football, CAF, Junior Biam, said the organizers asked for extra police and security to be put in place ahead of the final.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Segun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi and Nightline Africa Sports.
Meanwhile, CAF has fined Equatorial Guinea for the crowd violence. The hosts were fined $100,000 on Friday for the behavior of their supporters during the semi-final loss to Ghana. Though part of their sanction is that they must play their next game behind closed doors, that part was suspended, hence they had spectators at their third place match on Saturday. Equatorial Guinea was also fined $5,000 on Monday for an invasion of the pitch by a few spectators after the country's upset win over Tunisia in the quarterfinal in Bata. Talking about sanctions, Morocco has been banned from the next 2 African Nations Cup tournaments as punishment for withdrawing from hosting the 2015 finals over Ebola fears. That means the Moroccans will miss the 2017 and 2019 Africa Cup of Nations tournaments. The Royal Moroccan Football Federation, FRMF, has also been fined $1 million and ordered to pay $9.12 million in damages to CAF and their partners, CAF said in a statement. Claims of force majeure, which is an unexpected and disruptive event that may excuse a party from a contract, were rejected from the Federation by CAF. Morocco had requested for the continental tournament to be postponed by a year to allow the Ebola outbreak in West Africa to be contained. The North African country was stripped of its hosting right by CAF in November last year, with the tournament switched to Equatorial Guinea, which stepped in at the last minute. Staying with the Nations Cup, CAF President Issa Hayatou is angry at the international media coverage of Equatorial Guinea's violence-mad Africa Cup of Nations semi-final, claiming it's, quote, perpetuated colonization, unquote. The press always dramatize, particularly the Western press. When something bad happens in Europe, they say it's an error. When something happens in Africa, they begin talking about corruption, Hayatou said. He compared the reporting of Thursday's violence with the coverage given to a Euro 2012 qualifier between Serbia and Italy, which was stopped due to crowd trouble. What happened in that match between Serbia and Italy is the same as what happened here. But when it's Africa, it's different, Hayatou said. Speaking at the same press conference, President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, agreed with Hayatou. Good news is no news. Bad news is news, Blatter told reporters on Saturday at the signing of a memorandum of understanding between FIFA and CAF. I don't see the negative side of African football that the media presents, Blatter said. Finally, with the curtain falling on the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, all eyes are now on CAF to select the hosts of the 2017 edition. Algeria, Egypt, Gabon and Ghana remain contenders to host the 2017 tournament. Original 2017 host Libya withdrew because of ongoing violence in the North African nation. The CAF Executive Committee will choose the 2017 host this year on a date yet to be announced. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Some of them keep for me. Every time the people don't sing. Some of them wanna whine for me. Some of them boogie down for me. They love the way the ladies are whine for me. Everybody now. Let go. Hey. Everybody go. Hey. I like the way you do it. Hey. Huh. What did you say? All my ladies are whine on me. See girls said, hey. All my pupunga you there.
I'm
pray for blessings. Daily, you do it like a oh, my people, baby. Them, they pray for blessings. For better living.
This one I go, yeah. I got.
see my Johnny.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. A titanic economic struggle is being played out in Europe that African economic policy makers and other stakeholders should follow closely. How the current impasse is resolved may offer guidance and lessons to many African countries that are struggling to promote genuine growth of their economy. The protagonists in this economic struggle are the major economic powers in Europe, Germany, and the United Kingdom that hold firmly to the doctrine of austerity as the best means to tackle the second Great Depression that was discernible in 2008. Austerity involves major reduction in government public spending and observance of strict fiscal policy. The anti-austerity countries in Europe believe that austerity measures are unhelpful, since they call for severe cuts in public service and resulting in high unemployment and no growth, thus widening the inequality gap between the very rich and the middle class and poor. Germany and its chancellor, along with its foreign minister, are widely perceived as the fiscal enforcer of the austerity doctrine. When President Hollande of France was campaigning for his job, he sounded as an anti-austerity defender. However, after his election, he has tempered his anti-austerity approach. But there is a new and determined anti-austerity promoter in Europe. Recently, in a crucial election in Greece, a leftist party that is strongly opposed to the austerity doctrine won the election in a landslide, defeating the ruling Conservative Party that had accepted in 2012 the austerity program of the Eurozone. The application of the austerity policy has caused severe suffering for the people of Greece. Initially, it has been expected that the new anti-austerity government may have to exit the Eurozone as there was no prospect of the government meeting its bailout obligations of $274 billion. But the new Greek government and its foreign minister and prime minister decided last week to see whether there could be a delay in its meeting of its obligations. The government is talking of remaining in the Eurozone. While the French government has been flexible, the German chancellor and a finance minister have showed no willingness to make any changes. The argument is that Greece must meet all its obligations under the same terms as before. This has caused some worry as to whether the new government in Greece will default, something which will affect the financial market. However, after the result of the Greek election were reported, there have been some uprising in some other European countries who wish to follow the Greek example. In this regard, the fiscal enforcer are concerned of the epidemic effect of the Greek elections in Europe, and that therefore determined to stop its movement. There is a fundamental democratic principle involved in this struggle between the European Union and Greece. The people of Greece have given a firm endorsement or mandate to their new government to abandon the austerity program. But they are being told by the enforcers that despite the result of the election, they must honor their obligations. At this stage, agreement has been reached only on two minor points: that Greece will maintain European unity and that Greece will remain in the Eurozone. Incidentally, there is no reason why all members of the European Union must be in the Eurozone. Sweden and the United Kingdom, for example, are not in the Eurozone. Officials in Africa who are responsible for economic management know full well that they have always been under the straitjacket of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. They must follow strict macroeconomic principles, no matter whether this hurts the people or not. What should African governments do if they find themselves in the same position of Greece, when the people have voted them into power, asking them to support them, and yet they are being told by the financial oligarchs that they must follow the market and specific policy? This is a very serious dilemma. I thank you.
Thanks very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Wagner Robert, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders in Kenya say, monkeys do not advise their young ones to be careful on trees. They just remind them of the distance to the ground. I'm your host, Peter Clotta, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a clear link between endemic corruption and violent extremism. Corruption on a large scale often results in and from poor governance, leading to the root conditions that too often breed or give sanctuary to violent extremism: anger, moral outrage, and disaffection for a system or society that allows some to thrive through dishonesty at the expense of the rest. Where there is weak governance or a lack of quality education, economic opportunity, or respect for human rights, citizens are most at risk of being alienated by or from their governments and each other, noted Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. This is not just about ideological affinity. It is about alienation and anger that drives communities to align with or tolerate the violent extremists. Thus, ISIL in Iraq was able to exploit disillusionment with corrupt officials to garner support among some of the civilian population, not because they shared ISIL's perverse religious stance, but because both opposed the government. And in some other parts of the world, various violent extremist groups that sow chaos and misery have used corruption and the absence of good governance as a potent recruitment tool, as the Taliban has in Afghanistan. Other violent extremist groups have gained footholds or wreaked havoc in countries where the security forces have been weakened by endemic corruption, as Al-Shabaab has in Somalia and Kenya, or Boko Haram in Nigeria. Corruption is just one of the enablers of violent extremism, and efforts to combat it will need to be taken in concert with a number of policy and programmatic interventions if we are to stem the growth of violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. This includes strengthening civilian institutions so they not only provide security, but provide legal avenues to hold elected officials accountable and respond to the needs of their citizens, ensuring inclusive governance to reduce political or socioeconomic marginalization of particular groups. It means building secure and resilient communities in which the vulnerable don't need to align with extremist groups to address their concerns, said Undersecretary Sewell. And it means weakening the appeal of extremist ideology by amplifying the voices of leaders who promote tolerance, peace, and diversity, and who speak out against violence against civilians. Violent extremists exploit public discontent with corruption to garner support. Thus, eliminating corruption is key to rolling back and marginalizing extremism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.